The Fuller Memorandum, Disc 5.
Chapter 9. Night Shift. Walking to the office isn't something I'd normally do, because it takes about 3 hours, but I'm feeling inconveniently surveilled, and I don't like the idea of the Maginot Blue Stars network being able to track me. So I follow the footpath for another half kilometre before reigniting the Hand of Glory and dashing back almost all the way I've come, then exiting onto a side street. I take two corners and jump a fence into somebody's backyard before I extinguish the hog again, then walk out casually with my shoulders back and my chin up. A bus ride in an irrelevant direction takes me 10 minutes farther away from the office. Then it's into a back alley and time to reignite the hog for a brisk kilometre. Finally, I snuff it out and catch a different bus that passes close enough to the new annex that I can walk from the stop. I march up to the darkened C&A staff entrance and key my number, then swipe my pass card. The door clicks and I step inside. It's totally black, and in the gloom I can hear the restless shuffling of one of the night staff. I pull out my warrant card hastily, lest I be eaten by a grue. Arguing with the night watchman is singularly futile, unless you do it with a chainsaw or a baseball bat. Get me a torch, I snap. The warrant card is all very well. It sheds a faint, nacreous glow. But the backlight invocation has unpleasant side effects if you crank up the lumens too high. Why is it that all the movies make it look as if wizards find invoking light easy? Tenuous glows and balefire are all very well, but there's a reason we use fluorescent tubes around here.
Rains?
He asks plaintively. A torch flicks on, and I see the wizened face of its holder. Here, give me that. I take the torch, being careful to hold the warrant card between me and the doorman. I think he might be Fred from accounting, but if so, he's definitely a bit the worse for wear these days. It's several years since he died, and not everyone around here gets the deluxe Jeremy Bentham treatment. Mostly, HR just arrange for one of us to stick them in a summoning grid and bind one of the eaters in the night to service. Weak, minimally sentient efflorescences of alien will that can animate a corpse and control it just about enough to push a broom, or scare the living daylights out of unwanted nighttime visitors. I gather it saves on funeral expenses. Stay here and forget I came this way. That's an order. I climb the stairs, leaving the residual human resource behind to eat any unwitting B-team cultists who are stupid enough to tail me. It's past midnight, and they make regular inspection rounds, so I keep my card out and hope like hell the battery in this plastic piece of shit lasts until I make it to my office. I keep a proper torch there, a mag light that'll work properly when it's time to go visit Angleton's lair and turf those files from top to bottom. Luckily, the plastic piece of shit holds out, and I let myself in, flick on the light, shut the door, and flop down behind my desk with a sigh of relief.
Took your time getting here, didn't you, boy?
In the time it takes me to peel myself off the ceiling and return my pistol to its holster, Angleton takes up residence in my visitor's chair, folding his ungainly limbs around himself like a spindly black spider. The skeletal, humourless grin tells me I'm in trouble even before I open my mouth.
I've waited here for 3 consecutive nights. What delayed you?
I close my mouth. Then I open it and close it again a couple of times, just for practice. Finally, when I trust myself to speak, I say one word. Cultists.
3 days, boy. Suppose you tell me what you've learned.
One moment. My paranoia is growing. I take out my phone and peer at him through its camera. True Seer tells me that I am indeed looking at my boss, who is looking increasingly irritated. I make the shiny vanish. Okay, from the top. The Fuller Memorandum is missing, the Russians have gotten all upset, cultists are throwing their toys out of the pram, and everyone wants to know about the teapot. Oh, and someone in research and development says that Case Nightmare Green isn't going to wait a couple of years, but is due to kick off in a few weeks or months at the most. What am I missing? Angleton stares at me coldly.
You're missing the spy, boy.
I nearly swallow my tongue. Spy?
Yes. Helen Langhorne, aged 74, widow of Flight Lieutenant Adrian Langhorne, long-term resident of Cosford, working part-time at the museum as a volunteer. Met her husband while she was in the WRAAF back in 1963, which is a pretty interesting occupation for her to have been in, considering that she was also a captain in the Russian army and a GRU illegal who was inserted into the UK in 1959 when she was barely out of her teens.
I make an inarticulate gurgling noise. But she... the hangar, she wasn't... she can't have... Angleton waits for me to wind down.
The many angled ones are not the only enemy this country has ever faced, boy. Some of us remember.
It's okay for him to say that. I was about 10 when the Cold War ended.
Helen Langhorne's primary assignment did not come to an end just because the Soviet Union collapsed. To outward appearances, her utility had been in decline for many years, after her husband failed to achieve advancement, costing her access to people and bases. Once she hit 60, with no long-term prospects, they wrote her off. This is one of the risks one runs with long-term illegals. Their entire life may be marginalized by one or two unfortunate and unpredictable errors. There are probably 50 others like her in the UK. Retired bank managers and failed politicians' wives pruning their privet hedges and daydreaming of the revolution that failed them. Or perhaps they accept it gladly, happy to no longer be a pawn on the chessboard. But in any case, Helen's career appears to have undergone a brief second flowering in the last few years.
But she... I flap my jaws inarticulately. She was halfway to dementia.
Was she?
Angleton raises a skeptical eyebrow.
She was on the front desk of a museum gallery barely 200 meters from Hangar 12B, where airframe 004 is being cannibalized for spare parts to keep the other three white elephants airworthy.
You may think that no more than a coincidence, but I don't.
You never told me what that stuff about the white elephants was about.
I expected you to find out for yourself, boy.
Then Angleton does something I absolutely never expected to see. He sighs unhappily. Boss? Angleton leans back in his chair.
Tell me about Cheveline, he asks.
Cheveline? I frown. Wasn't that some sort of nuclear missile program from the 60s or 70s, something like that?
Cheveline.
He pauses.
Back in the 1960s, when Harold Wilson cut a deal with Richard Nixon to buy Polaris missiles for the Royal Navy, the tacit assumption was that a British nuclear deterrent need merely be sufficient to pound on Moscow until the rubble bounced. During the 1970s, the Soviets began to construct an anti-ballistic missile shield around Moscow. It was crude by modern standards, anti-missile rockets with nuclear warheads, but it would have rendered the British Polaris force obsolete. So, during the 1970s, a succession of Conservative and Labour governments pushed through a warhead upgrade scheme that replaced the original MRV warheads with far more sophisticated MIRV buses, equipped with decoys and able to engage two targets rather than one. The project was called Cheveline. It cost £1 billion back in the day, when £1 billion was real money, and they didn't even tell the cabinet.
£1 billion? With no oversight? I blink rapidly. We're subject to spot audits on office stationery, all the way down to paperclips.
Yes.
Angleton smiles sepulchrally.
We helped ensure security, so that it was relatively easy for them to spend an extra £200 million in 1977 to keep the Concorde production lines at Filton and Bristol open for long enough to produce 4 extra airframes for the RAF,
Angleton says blandly.
The plumbers ensured that nobody remembered a thing afterwards.
RAF 666 Squadron fly Concordes?
Flew them,
Angleton corrects me.
The long-range occult reconnaissance model, not the nuclear-armed model the RAF originally asked for in 1968. You may not be aware of this, but prototype 002 was built with attachment points for a bomb bay before the project was abandoned. Bomber Command wanted to replace V-Force with a fleet of supersonic bombers that could carry blue steel nuclear standoff bombs to Moscow. But the Navy won the toss. Instead, the RAF got the recon version, with supercargo space for the 6 demonologists and the optics bench to open the gate they needed to fly through.
My jaw is beginning to ache from all the speechless opening and closing cycles. You're shitting me. Angleton shakes his head.
The squadron was based in Filton and Heathrow, flying in British Airways livery. The aircraft movements were described as charter flights, and they wore the hull numbers of BA airframes that were currently undergoing maintenance. They flew one mission a week, departing west over the Atlantic. They refueled from a VC-10 tanker. Then the supercargo would open a gate, and they'd make a high-speed run across the dead plateau before reopening the gate home and landing at Filton for decontamination and exorcism. It's all in Codicil Black Skull, which you are cleared to read, incidentally.
I shake myself and take a deep breath. Let me get this straight. You're telling me that the RAF has a squadron of Black Concords which they currently keep in a hangar at RAF Cosford? Helen Langhorne was a former Soviet spy who, by a happy accident, for her employers, was in a position to poke around them? Which she did, with results that... I shudder, remembering again. A purple flash, face shrinking and crumpling in on itself around the harsh lines of her skull. And now the 13th Directorate are sniffing round?
Very good. We'll make a professional paranoid out of you one of these days.
Angleton nods, grudging approval.
Concord?
I do a double take. But they've been retired, right?
That put a crimp on the cover story, certainly. These days they fly only at night, described as American B-1Bs, if anyone asks. A big bomber with four engines and afterburners is a much flimsier cover, and the plane spotters and conspiracy theorists keep the plumbers busy, but we cannot neglect the watch on the dead plateau. If the thing in the pyramid should stir...
He makes an abrupt cutting gesture with the edge of one hand. Dead plateau? Thing in the pyramid? I've got no idea what he's referring to, but it sounds ominous.
You've been through a gate to elsewhere.
I remember a world in the grip of Fimbulwinter, where the rivers of liquid air ran down through valleys of ice beneath a moon carved with the likeness of Hitler's face.
There are other, more permanent, elsewheres. Some of them we must monitor continuously. That world, pray you never see it, boy, and pray that the sleeping god in the pyramid never awakens.
I tilt my head from side to side, trying to spill the invisible goop that's clogging up my mind. Thinking in here is difficult, as if the air, hazy with the congealed fumes of state secrets, is impeding my ability to reason.
Boss, why are you here? Everyone thinks you've gone missing, AWOL with no forwarding address.
Angleton grins skeletally.
Good. Let's keep it that way.
My eyes are feeling hot and gritty from too much stress and too little sleep, but I manage to roll them anyway.
Big problem. You just tipped me off. Can you give me a reason not to out you to the bloody Baron team, other than because I said so?
Of course.
He looks increasingly, alarmingly amused. What have I gotten myself into this time?
You'll keep it to yourself, because while the cat's away, the mice may play, and one of this particular bunch of mice appears to be a security leak, and I'm setting a trap for them. You're the bait, by the way.
I'm the...
And to sex you up so they come after you, I've got a little job for you to do.
Right, that's it. I'm through with...
Assuming you want to nail the scum responsible for the Club Zero incident in Amsterdam.
Fucking cultists. Really?
Yes, Bob.
He has the good grace not to look too smug.
Now shut up and listen. There's a good boy.
He deposits a slim memo on my desk, then places a small plastic baggie on top of it. I squint at it. It's empty except for a paperclip.
Here's what I want you to do.
Classified. Teapots Baron Tyburn. From Fuller Laundry. To 17F, Naval Intelligence Division.
Dear Ian, hope all's well, and my best regards to your mother. Long may she keep her nose out of operational matters. You inquired about Teapot. Subsequent to the death of Berdakovsky in 1921, Q Division determined that the Preter, referenced in the Sternberg fragment, had returned to the Six Paths, and if it could be recalled and bound into a suitable host, it might be compelled to the service of the state. Given the magnitude of the powers possessed by this particular entity, this was considered a desirable objective. However, its reincarnation required that we provide the hungry ghost with a new host. Obviously, this presented them with a headache, so some bright spark finally came up with the idea of asking the Home Office. A request was accordingly submitted in 1923. Due to the 1924 election and subsequent upheavals and crises, the request was not actually considered at ministerial level until 1928, in which year the Prime Minister and Home Secretary agreed, not without considerable argument, to sanction the use of the ritual as an alternative method of capital punishment on one occasion only. I am not at liberty to disclose the identity of the murderer in question. He has in any case paid the ultimate price, but after his hanging was announced, he was relocated to a secret location. No less a surgeon than Mr. Gillies, working under an oath of strict secrecy, was employed to remodel the features of the sacrificial vessel, lest any former acquaintance recognize him. Then the hungry ghost ritual was performed, in a ceremony so harrowing that I would not relish being called upon to perform it again. I shall not burden you with the tiresome sequence of obstacles that fate threw before us after we summoned the teapot. Teaching it to speak and to walk and to make use of a human body once more was tedious in the extreme. For example, we had to straitjacket and gag it for the first 6 months, lest it eat its fingers and lips. For almost a year, it seemed likely that we had made a horrible mistake and had merely driven a condemned murderer into the arms of insanity. However, in early 1930, Teapot began to communicate, and then to retrieve portions of the deceased memories, speaking in Russian as well as English, a language with which the vessel was unfamiliar. Shortly thereafter, it began also to evince a marked skill in the more esoteric areas of mathematics, and to show signs of the monstrous, cold intellect that so disturbed Baron von Ungern-Sternberg. When the Teapot Committee received permission to reincarnate the Preter, it was immediately realized that we would need to bind it to our service. Ungern-Sternberg was able to placate it with a steady supply of victims, but His Majesty's government, in time of peace, was not so well placed. If we had received the go-ahead to deal with the socialists, things would have been different, but it's no use crying over spilt milk. Consequently, from 1928 to 1930, we worked tirelessly on a new model gesh, or binding, one that can restrain not only a human soul, but an eater of same. I shall spare you the grisly details, but in April 1930, we performed the binding rite for the first time, and Teapot was demonstrated to be under our full authority. It did not submit willingly, and I regret to inform you that the death of Dr. Sommerfeld in that year, attributed to an apoplectic fit in his obituary in the Times, was only one part of the heavy price we paid. Having bound the Angra Mainyu, it was now necessary to indoctrinate it and train it to pass for a true Englishman. To this end, we obtained a place for it as maths tutor in Sherborne, where it was enrolled in Lion House as a master. Every public school in England is crawling with masters who are not entirely right in the head, as a result of their experiences on the front, and it was our consensus opinion that Teapot's more minor eccentricities would not attract excessive notice, while the major ones, such as the regrettable tendency to eat souls, could be kept under control by our Gesh. I retired from the Teapot Committee with my official retirement from service in 1933. I did not encounter Teapot again until 1940, and my reactivation in this highly irregular role. Today, Teapot is almost unrecognizable. When we set out to turn the monster into an Englishman, we succeeded too well. He is urbane, witty, possessed of a wicked but well-concealed sense of humor, and utterly lacking in the conscienceless brutality of the hungry ghost that possessed Ensign Yevgeny Burdakovsky in Ulaanbaatar all those years ago. Sherborne did its usual job, that of turning savages into servants of empire, and did it to our carefully constructed housemaster just as thoroughly as to any Hottentot from the home counties. I am afraid that our initial objective, to chain a hungry ghost to the service of the state, has only been a qualified success, qualified because we succeeded too well. Teapot sincerely believes in playing the game, in honor and service and all the other ideals we cynically dismiss at our peril. Unfortunately, this renders him less than useful for the task in hand. We have, I hesitate to say this, reformed a demon in our own image, or rather, in the image we were trained to revere. We would be fools to undo this work now. This Preta knows us too well. We captured it once, but next time we might not be so lucky. Despite being useless to us as an eater of souls, Teapot is not without worth. I have drafted it into this new organization, where I believe we can put it to good use while maintaining a discreet watch. We can always use a hungry ghost, possessed of a disturbing brilliance in the dark arts, hidden within the urbane skin of an Englishman. It understands what makes us tick, shares, thanks to years of compulsion and indoctrination, our goals, and it has an eerie judgment of character, too. I believe it may be of significant use to the Double Cross Committee in rooting out enemy spies. But if you're thinking of using it as a weapon, I would advise you to think again. I'm not sure the Gesh or Teapot's indoctrination would hold together if it is allowed to unleash its full power. Teapot is the sort of gun you fire only once. Then it explodes in your hand. Signed, J.F.C. Fuller.
I'm not going to explain how I got here from there. Just take it as a given that it is now 10 o'clock in the morning. I'm still in the office, but called Mo half an hour ago to see she's okay. I haven't shaved or slept, and there's a bloody Baron meeting in 5 minutes. I've got Amarok running on my desktop, playing Drowning in Berlin on endless repeat, because I need a pounding beat to keep me awake. And I've ploughed through the Codicil Black Skull file that Angleton left me, and then on into a bunch of tedious legwork for this morning's session. I'm suffering from severe cognitive dissonance. Every so often you think you've got a handle on this job, on the paperclip audits and interminable bureaucracy and committee meetings, and then something insane crawls out of the woodwork and gibbers at you. Something crazy enough to give James Bond nightmares that just happen to be true. I close the CBS file, and I'm just sticking it back in my secure document safe, when Iris pops her head round the door.
Bob, are you ready to do battle with Bloody Baron yet?
I groan quietly. I think I need a coffee, but yeah, I'll be along just as soon as I've locked this. I poke at the keypad, and it twiddles happily. Not that an electronic lock is the only security we rely on. Anyone who tries to crack this particular safe is going to wake up in hospital with a hangover the size of a whale.
White, no sugar, right?
You're a star. I'll be right with you. Did I remember to say good management cures the king's evil and makes coffee too? Because if not, it's all true. 10 minutes later, I'm sitting in room 206 again, with a mug of passable paint stripper in front of me and a printout of the minutes. It's a very cut-down rump session today. France is absent, Iris is tapping her fingers, and Shona is looking as if she'd like to be away with the fairies while Chaudhry drones on. No observed deviations from traffic intercept patterns established over the past week, and no notified agent movements yesterday. What the hell? I'm bored. I clear my throat. Chaudhry glances at me, irritated. What is it, Howard? These non-existent agent movements wouldn't happen to include Panin, would they? Because I'm sure if Panin so much as farted in F-flat minor, our boys would be up his arse with a gas spectrograph, wouldn't they? I'm pleased to see that both Shona and Iris are paying attention. Shona's nostrils flare unconsciously, and Iris raises an eyebrow at me. Chaudhry, however, is a harder nut. He frowns. Don't be silly. Of course they'd spot him if he was in the UK. Really? I lean back, cross my arms, and bare my teeth at him. Maybe he'll mistake it for a grin. Explain last night, then. He stops dead. What happened last night? I glance at the sit-rep folder. Panin isn't in the UK, according to that folder. So how exactly is it that he picked me up as I was leaving work and bought me a pint of ESB in the Frog and Tourette's? Preposterous, Chaudhry glares. Neither Shona nor Iris is smiling. You'd better explain, Iris tells me. What I said. Here is a hint. Panin knew. He tried to pump me about Teapot, so I played dumb. He knows the rules, left me a calling card. It's downstairs in the security office safe. For reasons of operational security, I didn't report the contact immediately, but I'm reporting it now. The plumbers should be able to confirm it from the pub CCTV. I sit up.
Personally, I find the implications highly suggestive.
Why did you not tell security?
Shona stops, her eyes widening. We're not as secure as we'd like to be. I'd rather not spread it around beyond this committee for the time being. Iris's brows furrow. You're taking rather a lot on your shoulders, aren't you?
I'm only doing what Angleton would advise.
Chaudhry has spent the past 30 seconds or so looking hurt and offended. Now he collects his dignity.
This can't possibly be right. Oversight don't get their movement reports wrong. Perhaps you were taken in by an imposter. I assure you, you didn't see Panin last night. He was in Madrid.
I am getting tired of this shit. According to your sit rep, he was sighted in Madrid at 4 p.m., I point out. That's plenty of time to catch a flight into London City and accost me outside the front door at 8:15. If you had bothered to check the duty rotor behind that sighting. Gosh, I didn't know he could turn that shade of pink. You'd know that the Madrid office files their report at 5 local time, which is 1600 hours on British summertime, and they go home at 6. And if you got out from behind your desk once in a while, you'd know that the Madrid office consists of 2 cotton tops and their pet chihuahua, whose job is to take whatever the Guardia Civil feeds them and barf it over the wire on demand, rather than actually running surveillance boxes on visiting opposition controllers. Like I said, the pub CCTV, not to mention the Maginot Blue Stars Network and Punin's mobile phone company's log files, will back me up on this. I'm right, you're wrong, and I would appreciate it if you'd stop acting like a complete prat and pay attention. I find that during my little rant I must have stood up. I'm leaning over the table, balanced on my fists, and Chaudhry is leaning over backwards in his chair, not balanced in the slightest.
This is harassment, he sputters. Intimidation.
No. I sit down hastily before Iris can get a word in. Intimidation is when you're boxed in by a 13th Directorate officer and 2 Spetsnaz thugs he borrowed from the embassy. I'd recommend it sometime. It'll be good practice for when the auditors decide to rake you over the coals. Shona has been bottling it up for some time, and now she lets rip.
Bob, what exactly did Panin want? I think you'd better make a full statement right now.
That's right. She's with Oscar, same as Joe, isn't she? Panin tried to pump me. I don't pump easily. His specific concern is teapot. The teapot is missing, he told me. You'd better find it before the wrong people get their hands on it and use it to make tea. There was a lot of tap dancing, but that's the basic substance of it. I carefully avoid thinking about our inconclusive exchange on the topic of Amsterdam, which is now looking even murkier in context. They do that, you know, to muddy the waters. Fucking cultists. He offered to trade if we have anything to offer.
Wonderful.
Shona is making notes.
So that's it?
Substantially, yes. Because all I know for sure about the cultist connection is inference and Angleton's instructions. Thus do we damn ourselves by the treachery of our own words.
Okay, I'll compile this and add it to the minutes, so at least we've got it on paper somewhere. That should cover you. Then we can decide how and when to send it up the chain.
She stares at me blackly.
I assume that's why you brought it up here?
Yes. I want to keep it confidential to the Bloody Baron Committee for now. I'm worried about how Panin knew who to talk to and where to find him. Not to mention when. Iris speaks up. Yes, that's very disturbing. She looks appropriately disturbed for a split second, then flexes her management muscle. Vikram, would you be a dear and make sure to accidentally lose the minutes of this session between your desk and your email program? I think it wouldn't hurt for distribution to be delayed for a few days until the situation settles one way or the other. Despite the aging biker chick style that she affects, the temperament and training of a steely home county's matron lurk not too far under the skin. Put her in twinset and pearls, and you can see her biting the heads off hunt saboteurs. When she turns the big guns on Chaudhry, he runs up the white flag at once.
Certainly, madam.
He spares me a poisonous glance, which I ignore.
SSO3 Howard's unfortunate encounter will be thoroughly misfiled until I hear otherwise. Do you expect Panin to make contact again?
Shona demands.
In your personal judgment?
Now that's a question and a half. He left me a card in case I want to contact him, but I wouldn't rule it out. I got the impression he was worried about timing. If the 13th Directorate are running to some kind of schedule, we need to know, don't we?
Iris looks grimly pleased.
Minute that. Schedules.
Shona stares at Vikram.
What does the calendar have for us?
The calendar, it's August bank holiday in a couple of weeks.
I believe she was asking about significant intersections, Iris interrupts, sparing me a quelling glance.
Summit conferences, international treaties, Mayan great cycle endings, general elections, prophesied apocalypses, that sort of thing.
It'll be an outlook under events. You're the one with a laptop, why don't you look it up?
Chaudhry manages to look long-suffering.
What exactly am I supposed to be looking for? Anything.
Shona makes a curse of the word.
Whatever might interest Panin.
I blink. Suddenly, a rather unpalatable thought occurs to me. Forget dates that interest Panin. What about dates relevant to the teapot? Assuming the teapot in question is the one I'm thinking of. Trying not to be too obvious about it, I pull out my phone and start hunting. There's an ebook reader and a Wikipedia client and a bunch of other stuff. What was Ungern Sternberg's adjutant called again?
Bob, what are you doing?
It's Iris. I grin apologetically. Checking a different calendar. 19 August 1921. That's when the mutineers murdered Teapot. At least that's when they said they did the deed.
And the 90th anniversary is coming up in the next week.
How interesting. I quickly scan for other significant anniversaries on that date. Salem witch trial executions, Hungerford massacre, 20th anniversary of the collapse of the USSR. No, sorry, nothing there, I say, putting my phone away. Liar, liar, pants on fire. It's like this. If you were going to try and break the Gesh that restrains an extra-dimensional horror called the Eater of Souls, wouldn't you pick the anniversary of its last taste of freedom? Dates have resonance, after all, and this particular horror has been living quietly among human beings, the lion lying down with the lamb, for so long that our patterns of thought have imprinted upon it. Isn't that just the sort of nutso thing that the cultists might be up to? Trying to free a vastly powerful occult force from its laundry-imposed chains? And isn't this exactly the sort of thing that Panin might anticipate? Well, maybe. There's a slight motivational gap. Just what makes cultists tick, anyway? Besides the obvious, having your head turned by a hugely powerful glamour, being bound by a Gesh, that sort of thing, what's in it for them? Fucked if I know. I mean, what makes your average high school shooter tick, for that matter? Suddenly, not knowing is making me itch. But the only person who can answer for sure is the one person I don't dare to ask, Angleton.
Maybe we could wire Bob, Shona suggests.
What? I shake my head. What do you mean?
If Panin makes contact again, it would really help if you had a recording angel,
she points out. There was a word in that sentence. If. I look at Iris for support, but she's nodding thoughtfully along with Shona. Panin's not going to make contact on working hours, and if it's all right by you, I'd rather not wear a wire during all my off-duty life. Now, if you want me to use that business card and wear a recorder while we're talking, that's another matter. But I think we ought to have something to trade with him before we go there, otherwise he's not going to give us anything for free. Point, says Iris. Vikram looks at me through slitted eyes.
We should wire him anyway, he suggests maliciously. Just in case.
I sink back in my chair, racking my brain for plausible defences. We've only been in this meeting for half an hour, and already it feels like a decade. What a morning. But it could be worse. I've got to run Angleton's little errand at 2 o'clock. Chapter 10. The Nightmare Stacks. There is a railway under London, but it's probably not the one you're thinking of. Scratch that. There are many railways under London. There are the tube lines that everyone knows about, hundreds of kilometres, dozens of lines, carrying millions of people every day. And there are the London commuter rail lines, many of which run underground for part or all of their length. There are the other major railway tracks such as Crossrail and the Eurostar tunnel into St Pancras. There's even the Docklands Light Railway, if you squint. But these are just the currently operational lines that are open to the public. There are other lines you probably don't know about. There are the deep tube tunnels that were never opened to the public, built to serve the needs of wartime government. Some of them have been abandoned, others turned into archives and secure stores. There are the special platforms off the public tube stations, the systems built during the 1940s and 1950s to rush MPs and royalty away from the capital at an hour's notice in time of war. These are the trains of government, buried deep and half forgotten. And then there are the weird ones. The Necropolis Railway that ran from behind Waterloo to Brookwood Cemetery in Surrey, along the converted trackbed of which I ran last night. The coal tunnels that distributed fuel to the power stations of South London and the buried generator halls that powered the tube network. And the mail rail narrow gauge tunnels that for over a century hauled sacks of letters and parcels between Paddington and Whitechapel until it was officially closed in 2003. Closed? Not so fast. The stacks, where the laundry keeps its dead files, occupy 200-metre stretches of disused, deep-dug tube tunnel not far from Whitehall. They're 30 metres down, beneath the hole in the ground where Service House is currently being rebuilt by a private finance initiative, just in time for Case Nightmare Green. How do you think we get files in and out? Or librarians in and out, for that matter? Angleton has a job for me to do, down in the stacks. And so it is that at 1:30 I'm sitting in my office, nursing a lukewarm mug of coffee, and waiting for the little man with a handcart to call, when the Necronomipod begins to vibrate and makes a noise like a distressed U-boat. Hello? It's Mo. Bob? She doesn't sound too happy. Yeah? You at home?
Right now, yes. Not feeling too well.
I hunch over instinctively. Is there anything I can do?
Yes.
Oh, right.
Listen, about last night. Thanks, and thanks for letting me lie in. I'm just wrung out today, so I've begged off my weekly, and I was thinking about taking the afternoon to do what we talked about earlier, to go visit research and development. But there's a little job I needed to do in the office, and I was wondering if you could...
I glance at the clock on my desktop.
Maybe. Depends what. I'm off to the stacks in half an hour.
The stacks? In person? She cheers up audibly.
That's great. I was hoping you could pull a file for me, and if you're going there...
Not so fast. I pause. What kind of file?
A new one, a report I asked for. I can give you a reference code. It should be fresh in today.
Oh, right. Well, that shouldn't be a problem. I can probably fit it in with my primary mission. What's the number?
Let me...
She reads out a string of digits, and I read it back to her.
Yes, that's it. If you could just bring it home with you this evening.
Remind me again, who was it who didn't want work brought home?
That's different. This is me being lazy, not you overdoing it.
I smile. If you say so.
Love you.
You too. Bye. At 2:07, I hear footsteps and a squeak of wheels that stops outside my door. I pick up a pair of brown manila files I'm through with and stand. Archive service? I ask. The man with the handcart is old and worn before his time. He wears a blue-grey boiler suit and a cloth cap that has seen better days. His skin is as parched as time-stained newsprint. He looks at me with the dumb, vacant eyes of a residual human resource.
Archive service, he mumbles.
These are going back. I hand over the files, and he painstakingly inscribes their numbers on a battered plywood clipboard using a stub of pencil sellotaped to a length of string. And I'm going with them. He stares at me, unblinking.
Document number, he says.
I roll my eyes. Give me that. Taking the clipboard, I make up a shelf reference number and write it down in the next space. Then copy it onto my left wrist with a pen. See? I am a document. Take me.
Document number...
His eyes cross for a moment.
Come.
He puts his hands to the handcart and begins to push it along, then glances back at me anxiously.
Come.
For an RHR, he's remarkably communicative. I tag along behind him as he finishes his round, collecting and distributing brown manila envelopes that smell of dust and long-forgotten secrets. We leave the department behind, heading for the service lifts at the back. Rita doesn't even raise her head to nod as I walk past. The heavy freight lift takes forever to descend into the sub-basement, creaking and clanking. The lights flicker with the harsh edge of fluorescent tubes on the verge of burnout, and the ventilation fans provide a background white buzz of noise that sets my teeth on edge. There's nobody and nothing down here, except for storerooms and supply lockers. People visit, but only the dead stay. Handcart man shuffles down a narrow passage lined with fire doors. Pausing before one, he produces an antiquated-looking key and unlocks a padlock and chain from around the crash bar. Then he pushes his cart through into a dimly lit space beyond. "How do you relock that?" I ask him.
"Lock at night,"
he mumbles, throwing a big switch like a circuit breaker that's mounted on the wall just inside the door. We're in a narrow, long room with a couple of handcarts parked along one wall. The other side of the room is strange. There's a depression in the floor and a hole in each of the narrow ends. Rails run along the depression between the holes. Such is the wildly unusual scale of it all that it takes me several seconds to blink it back into the correct perspective and see that I'm standing on the platform of an underground railway station. A narrow gauge system with tracks about 60 centimeters apart and an electrified third rail. I hear a sullen rumbling from one of the tunnel mouths and feel a warm breath of wind on my face, like the belch of a very small dragon. The original mail rail track only ran east to west, but extensions were planned back in the 1920s. I suppose I shouldn't be surprised to find one here, for what else would commend this extremely boring 60s office block to the laundry as a temporary headquarters? I look at handcart man. "Can I ride this?" I ask. Instead of answering, he pulls a second lever. I shrug. You'd think I'd have learned better than to ask zombies complex questions by now, wouldn't you? The rumbling builds to a loud roar, and a remarkable object rolls out of the tunnel and screeches to a halt in the middle of the room. It's a train, of course. Three carriages, all motorized. But it's tiny. You could park it in my front hall. The roofs of the carriages barely rise waist high, and they sport external handles. Handcart man shambles to the front carriage and hinges the roof right up. Not even breaking a sweat, he begins to load the files from his cart into a storage bin. "Hey, what about..." I focus on the second carriage. It's got wire mesh sides and what looks like a bench. "Me." Handcart man lifts a box of files out of the front carriage, deposits it in his cart, and lowers the lid. Then he walks to the second carriage, lifts the roof, and looks at me expectantly. "I was afraid you were going to say that," I mutter, and climb in. The wooden bench seat is about 5 centimeters above the track bed, and I have to lean backward as he drops the lid with a clang. The carriage is only big enough for a single passenger. It smells musty and dry, as if something died in here a long time ago. Turning my head sideways, I watch as handcart man walks over to the big circuit breaker and yanks it down and up, down and up. It must be some kind of trackside signal, because a moment later I feel a motor vibrate under me, and the train starts to roll forward. I make myself lie down. It'd be a really great start to the mission to scrape my face off on the tunnel roof. And a moment later, I'm off, rattling feet first into the darkness under London on a false flag mission. At about the same time I'm falling feet first into a piece of railway history, another part of the plot is unfolding. Let me try to reconstruct it for you. A red-haired woman holding a violin case is making her way along a busy high street in London. Wearing understated trousers and a slightly dated Issey Miyake top, sensible shoes and a leather bag that's showing its age, she could be a college lecturer or a musician on her way to practice. Without the interview suit, nobody's going to mistake her for an auction house employee or a civil servant, which shows how deceptive appearances can be. Kids and shoppers and office workers in suits and shop staff in uniforms move around her. She threads her way between them, not looking in shop windows or diverting her attention from the destination in hand. Here's a side street, and she turns the corner wide, avoiding a baby buggy, its owner nattering on her mobile, and strides along it before turning into another, wider street, at a corner where a bland 70s office rises 6 stories above the pavement. The office has glass doors and a reception desk, fronting an austere atrium. A bank of lifts behind it promises a rapid ascent into crowded beige cubicle heaven. The woman approaches reception and holds up an ID card of some sort. The guard nods, signs her in, then waves her onto the lift bank on the right. She could be a session musician turning up at one of the TV production companies listed on the wall panel beside the reception desk, or a member of staff on her way back from a lunchtime lesson. But she's not. The lift control panel shows 5 numbered floors. As the door slides closed, the woman pushes the 3rd floor button, then 1st floor, twice, then the 4th floor. The lift begins to move. The illuminated floor display tracks it up from ground to 1st, 2nd, 3rd, and it goes out. Then, safely stranded between indicated floors, the doors open. There are no cubicles here, only rooms with frosted glass doors that lock shut and red security lights to warn against intrusion. Some of the rooms are offices, and some of them are laboratories, although the experiments that are conducted in them require little equipment more exotic than desktop computers and hand-wired electronic circuitry. The red-haired woman makes her way through the building with ease born of familiarity until she finds room 505. She knocks on the door.
"Come in,"
the occupant calls, his voice muffled somewhat by the wood. Mo opens the door wide.
"Dr. Mike," she says, smiling.
"Mo?"
He has a large head for his average-sized torso, brown hair fighting a hard-bitten retreat bound in a ponytail. His eyebrows, owlishly peaked, rise quizzically at her approach.
"Good to see you."
"It's been too long."
She walks in and they embrace briefly.
"Are you busy?"
"Not immediately, no."
His desk tells a different story, piled high in untidy snowdrifts of paper. There's a laser printer on a table in one corner, and a heavy-duty shredder right below it, with a coffee mug balanced atop one particularly steep pile. The mug reads, "During off-hours, trains stop here." There's a bookcase beside the desk, crammed full of phrasebooks and travel guides, except for one shelf, which is occupied by a tiny Z-gauge model railway layout.
"Were you passing through, or can I be of service in some way?"
"I was hoping to talk to you," she confesses. "About..."
She shrugs.
"Mind if I sit down?"
"It's the cross-section growth coefficient, isn't it?"
he asks, and one of his eyebrows tries to climb even farther.
"Yes, yes, make yourself comfortable. Everyone has been asking about it this week."
He sighs, then backs towards his own chair, bearish on his short legs.
"I got an edited, probably garbled version of it from Andy last week," she explains. "The original paper isn't on the intranet, so I thought I'd ask you about it."
She nods at the door.
"In person."
"Yes. Very wise."
His expression relaxes moment by moment.
"The scholars of night have been busy."
"Word leaked."
Saturnine, he rests one hand on a graph-ruled notepad.
"Or so I gather from Angleton."
"That's interesting."
Mo rests her violin against the side of her chair and crosses her legs.
"He's missing too, you know."
"That's very interesting."
Now Ford's expression lightens.
"The time has come," the walrus said, "to talk of many things."
Mo nods.
"Footwear and naval architecture I know, but I never could get my head around why you'd put wax in the ceiling. Some kind of late Victorian loft space insulation?"
"No, it's..."
Ford stops.
"Okay, you won that round. Is this about the paper or the leak?"
"The paper."
She leans forward expectantly.
"The first rule of paper is there is no paper. Well, no, not exactly, but it's not the kind of result I could punt at nature, is it?"
"Right, so who reviewed it?"
Ford nods.
"That's the right question. Whose hat are you wearing?"
Mo's eyes go very cold.
"There's a little girl in Amsterdam whose parents don't have much time for hair splitting right now. Not that I'm accusing you of playing games, but I need to know. See, I'm conducting some research in applied epistemology. It would be rather unfortunate if you made a mistake in your logic and the Brotherhood of the Black Pharaoh have gotten themselves worked up over nothing."
"The Brotherhood? I say, are they still going?"
He meets her cold stare with one of his own.
That is simply not on. I rather thought we'd put a stop to their antics in Afghanistan a few years ago.
They're a broad franchise. They've got any number of fronts.
She makes a gesture of dismissal.
Whoever, I'm looking into this on my own initiative. Do you have a draft I can see?
I think I could manage that.
He begins to hunt through the papers on his desk.
Ah, here.
He passes her three pages, held together by a paperclip. Mo peers at the top page.
Wait, I can't read.
Ah, just a moment.
Ford waves his left hand across the paper and mutters something unintelligible under his breath. Mo blinks.
Was that entirely safe?
He grins.
No.
I see.
She peers at the abstract.
That's interesting. Let me paraphrase. You've tried to quantify mimetic transmission effects among a population exposed to Class 3 abominations and find belief in them spreads? And it's a power function?
He nods.
You must understand. Previous models all seem to have looked at how possession spreads through a sparse network, like classical epidemiological studies of smallpox transmission, for example. But that's flawed. If you posit an uncontrolled outbreak, then people can see their neighbors, random strangers, being possessed. And that, in turn, weakens the observer-mediated grid ultrastructure, making it easier for the Preter to tunnel into our reality. It's a feedback loop. The more people succumb, the weaker everyone else's resistance becomes. I modeled it using linear programming, and the results are, well, they speak for themselves.
And the closer we come to the transient weak anomaly, the more outbreaks we're going to see, and it contributes to the strength of the TWA?
She looks at him sharply.
Substantially, yes.
Dr. Mike shuffles uncomfortably in his chair.
Well, shit.
She folds the paper neatly and slides it into her handbag.
And here I was hoping Andy had gotten the wrong end of the stick.
Second-order effects are always gonna get you.
He shrugs apologetically.
I don't know why nobody looked into it from this angle before.
Not your problem. Not my problem.
Says Werner von Braun, yes. And who says satire is dead?
Tom Lehrer, or maybe Buddy Holly.
Right. But you said something that interests me strangely. How did the Black Brotherhood, or whoever wants us to think they're the BBs, get the news?
That's what a lot of people are asking themselves right now.
She gives him a peculiar look.
It made quite a stir, unfortunately. Lots of wagging tongues. Unfortunately, Oscar are drawing blanks, and they can't audit the entire organization, at least not yet. We'll have to examine the second-order consequences if the cultists learn they've got a turbocharger, though. If you can come up with anything.
Angleton would be the one to talk about that, he says slyly. After all, he's the head of the counter-possession unit.
Angleton's missing.
Mo freezes. For a moment, they sit in silence. Then Dr. Mike raises one preposterous eyebrow.
Are you certain of that?
I'm glad I'm not claustrophobic. Well, I'm not very claustrophobic. Lying on my back in a coffin-sized railway carriage, rattling down a steep incline in a tunnel less than a metre in diameter that was built in the 1920s, is not my idea of a nice, relaxing way to spend an afternoon. Especially knowing that the station staff are zombies, and I'm barreling headfirst into the depths of a high-security government installation with only my warrant card to speak for me, on a mission of somewhat questionable legality.
Pull yourself together, Bob. You've been in darker holes.
Yes, but back then, Angleton at least had the good grace to tell me what the fuck I was supposed to be doing.
This time around, it's just, I want you to be my tethered goat. That and the 440-volt DC rail 15 centimetres below my spine give me a tingling sensation like my balls want to climb right up my throat and hide. I suppose I shouldn't be surprised that there's a back door into the stacks, or that it's a hinky little narrow-gauge tube system constructed by a quango and forgotten by everyone except train spotters, but to find myself actually riding it,
That's something else. Angleton had the decency to scribble me a written order, and a good thing too, otherwise I would have thrown a strop. The librarians don't appreciate unannounced visitors, much less informal withdrawals, and like so many of our more eccentric outposts, they have their own inimitable and unspeakable ways of dealing with vandals and intruders. If they catch me, a signed order from a DSS ought to make them pause long enough to give me a fair hearing before they rip my lungs out. But really and truly, it is usually best to just put in a request and wait for the little man with the cart. I try not to think too hard about everything that can go wrong with Angleton's plan. Instead, I lie back and think of libraries. The laundry keeps its archive stacks in a former tube tunnel. It was originally going to be a station, but during World War II it was converted into an emergency bunker, and in the end they never got around to connecting it up to the underground network. There are 6 levels rather than the usual 3. 2 levels built into each half of a cylindrical tunnel 8 meters in diameter, and nearly a third of a kilometre long. That makes for a lot of shelves. Not quite in the same league as the British Library, but close. And it's not just books that occupy the stacks. We store microfiche cards in binders, row after row of them, and there are rooms full of filing cabinets full of CD-ROMs. There's a lot of stuff down here. A lot of mouldering secrets and fatal lies. A complete transcript of every numbers channel transmitted since 1932. The last words of every spy hanged during the Second World War, every sermon preached by a minister in the Church of Night, our minister, before his followers found out and tore him toe from nail. The train tilts so that my feet are raised, and the clattering rush begins to slow. I've only been here for 3 or 4 minutes, but it feels like hours in the roaring dark. I cross my arms around my body, hugging myself, and try not to think about premature burials. Instead, I try to remember more secrets and lies, such as the recordings of every spy and defector executed by Abu Nidal. Famously paranoid, if he suspected a recruit of spying, he had them buried in a coffin, fed through a tube while being interrogated, after which they would be executed by a bullet fired down the same pipe. I gather he killed more of his own followers than any hostile power. The last confessions of every member of the Green Hand sect arrested and interrogated by the Kripo in Saxony in the late 1930s, which led to secret and unsanctioned executions, which the occupying powers declined to investigate after a brief, horrified review of the Nazi-era records. There is even a sealed box of DVDs containing high-resolution scans of the mechanical blueprints from the Atrocity Archives. That one was my own contribution to the stacks, I'm afraid. The carriage squeals to a halt. A few seconds later, I hear the clatter of lids being raised. I take this as my cue, and, bracing myself, I push against the roof. I sit up to find myself in another room, this time with a rounded, tunnel-like roof and raw brick walls. It's dimly lit by red lights set deep in shielded sockets. It smells of corruption and memories. A pair of residual human resources are lethargically unloading the wagon in front of me. I lever myself off the bench seat and clamber over the side of the carriage, trying not to bash my head on the low, curving ceiling. There are human-sized doors at either end of the platform, but I don't dare try them at random. I'm pushing my luck just by being here. Instead, I approach one of the shambling human figures and thrust my ink-stained forearm under what's left of its rotting nose. "Document," I say, stabbing my opposing index finger at the numbers. "File me." Leathery fingers close lightly around my wrist and tug me towards a half-loaded handcart. I grab onto the edge of it and the hand drops away. I suppress a shudder. One of the office unions is currently taking HR to court over the use of residuals, claiming it's a violation of their human rights. HR's argument is that once you're dead, you have no rights to violate. But the union's lawyers have said that if they lose the case, they'll bring a countersuit for interfering with corpses. Either that, or they'll demand equal pay for the undead. After a couple of minutes, one of the working stiffs shuffles over to a control board on one wall and starts pulling handles. With a grumbling buzz of motors and the screech of steel wheels on rails, the mail train rolls forward into the next tunnel mouth, on its way back to the realm of worms and darkness.
Then they take their handcarts and shamble slowly towards the farthest door. I walk alongside, resting one hand on the file cart at all times. Doors open and close. Using my free hand, I produce my warrant card and orders, then hold them clenched before me. We walk down whitewashed brick-lined passages, like the catacombs beneath a recondite order's monastery, dimly lit by yellowing bulbs. A cool breeze blows endlessly towards my face, into the depths of the mail rail tunnels. A twist in the passage brings us to another pair of riveted iron doors, painted battleship grey. It's probably their original wartime livery. I'm close to lost by this point, for I've never been in the lower depths of the stacks before. All my dealings have been with the front desk staff on the upper levels. The lead zombie places a claw-fingered hand on the door and pushes, seemingly effortlessly. The door swings open onto a different shade of darkness, a nocturnal gloom that raises goose flesh on my neck. I tighten my grip on the cart and swear at myself silently. I left my ward with Mo, didn't I? I hastily raise my warrant card and orders and grip them with my teeth, then fumble for the Necronomipod with my free hand. Should have replaced it. As my bearer walks forward, I thumb-tap the all-seeing eye into view and bring the phone's camera to bear. What I see does not fill me with joy. The dark on the other side of the portal isn't just due to an absence of light. It's the result of a very powerful ward. Being of a nasty and suspicious disposition, it strikes me as likely that it's part of a security cordon. After all, this is a secret document repository I'm trying to break into, isn't it? And I know what I'd plant just inside the back door if I was in charge of security. Shelob, or a good emulation thereof, the better to trap intruders in my sticky web. It's time to break from my assigned shelf space. So, not entirely regretfully, I let go of the document cart. Before the dead man walking can take me in hand again, I remove the papers from my mouth, then lick the ink on my wrist and frantically rub it on my jacket. Not a document, I crow, showing my smeary skin to the walking corpse. No need to push, file, stamp, index, brief, debrief, or number me. It stands still for a moment, rocking gently on the balls of its feet, and I can almost see the exception handler triggering in the buggy necro-symbolic script that animates and guides its behavior. A sudden thought strikes me, and I raise my warrant card. Command override, I bark. Command override. The zombie freezes again, its claws centimeters from my throat.
Override, it creaks. Identify authorization.
The other zombie standing behind it hisses like a truck's air brake. In the name of the counter-possession unit, on the official business of Her Majesty's Occult Service, I override you, I say very slowly. A harsh blue light from my warrant card shows me more of its death mask than I have any desire to remember. The next bit is hard. My Enochian is rusty, and I'm told I have an abominable accent, but I manage to pull together the ritual phrases I need. These residual human resources are minimally scriptable, as long as you've got the access permissions and know what you're doing. The consequences of getting it wrong are admittedly drastic, but I find that the prospect of a syntax error getting your brains gnawed out through a hole in your skull concentrates the mind wonderfully. If only we could convince Microsoft to port Windows to run on zombies. Although, knowing how government IT sector outsourcing is run, that's probably redundant. Accept new program parameters. Subroutine start. Or words to that effect in questionable medieval Cod Latin gibber speak. After 15 minutes of chanting, I'm cold with sweat and shaking with tension. My audience are displaying no signs of acquiring a taste for pâté de foie programmer, which is good, but if security is paranoid enough, they'll be flagged as overdue any minute now. End subroutine, amen, I intone. The zombies stand where they are. Oops, have I crashed them? I pull out my phone and fire up its poxy excuse for a personal ward, then stick it in my jacket's breast pocket. There's only one way to find out if this is going to work, isn't there? I snap my fingers. What are you waiting for? I ask, reaching into one of my pockets again. Let's go to work. The hand of glory has seen better days. The thumb is worn right down to the base of the big joint, and only two of the fingers still have unburned knuckles. But it'll have to do. Do we have ignition? Do we have fucking ignition? I snarl under my breath, and a faint blue glow like a guttering candle rises from each of the stumps. I climb into one of the document carts, carefully holding on to the waxy abomination, and the residual human resource gives me a tentative shove towards the dark. There's a tunnel out of nightmares in the library, in the underside of the world. I'm not sure I can quite describe what happens in there. Cold air, moist, the dankness and silence of the crypt broken only by the squeaking of the overloaded wheels of my cart. A sense of being watched, of a mindless and terrible focus sweeping across me, averted by the skin of the Hand of Glory's burning fingertips. A rigor fit to still the heart of heroes, and only the faint pulsing ward heart of my phone to bring me through it with QRS complex intact. There is a reason they use residual human resources to run the files to and from the mail rail system. You don't need to be dead to work here, but it really helps. I'm in the darkness for only 10 or 15 seconds, but when I come out, I am in soul-deep pain, my heart pounding and my skin clammy, as if on the edge of a heart attack. Everything is grey and grainy, and there is a buzzing in my ears, as of a monstrous swarm of flies. It disperses slowly as the light returns. I blink, trying to get a grip, and I realize that the handcart has stopped moving. Shivering, I sit up, and somehow slither over the edge of the cart without tipping the thing over. There's carpet on the floor, thin, beige, institutional. I'm back in the land of the living. I look round. There's a wooden table, three doors, a bunch of battered filing cabinets, and another door through which the mailmen are disappearing. Black-painted wood, with a motto engraved above the lintel, Abandon Hope. Trying to remember what I actually saw in there sends my mind skittering around the inside of my skull like a frightened mouse, so I give up. I'm still clutching the Hand of Glory. I hold it up to look at the flames. They're burned down deep, and there's little left but calcined bones. Regretfully, I blow them out one by one, then dispose of the relic in the recycling bin at one side of the table. No mailmen, but no librarians either. It's all very back office, just as Angleton described it. I head for the nearest door, just as it opens in front of me.
Hey.
I blink. Hello, I ask.
You're not supposed to be here,
he says, annoyed if not outright cross.
Visitors are restricted to levels 5 and 6 only. You could do yourself a mischief wandering around the sub-basement.
In his shirt and tie and M&S suit, he's like an intrusion from another, more banal universe. I could kiss him just for existing, but I'm not out of the woods yet. Sorry, I say contritely. I was sent to ask for a new document that's supposed to have come in this morning.
Well, you'd better come with me then. Let me see your ID, please.
I show him my warrant card and he nods.
All right, what is it you're after?
A file. I show him the slip of paper on which I've written down Moe's document reference. It's new, it should have come in this morning.
Follow me.
He leads me through a door, to a lift, up 4 levels and along a corridor to a waiting room with a desk and half a dozen cheap powder blue chairs. I vaguely recognize it from a previous visit.
Give me that and wait here.
I sit down and wait. 10 minutes later, he's back, frowning.
Are you sure this is right?
He asks. Annoyed, I think back.
Yes, I say.
I read the number back to Mo, didn't I? It's a new file, deposited last night.
Well, it's not here yet.
He shrugs.
It may still be waiting to be allocated a shelf, you know. That happens sometimes if adding a new file triggers a shelf overflow.
Oh. Mo won't be happy, I guess, but it establishes my cover.
Well, can you flag it for me when it comes in? Certainly. If you can show me your card again?
I do so, and he takes a note of my name and departmental assignment.
Okay, Mr. Howard, I'll send you an email when the file comes into stock. Is that everything?
Yes, thanks. You've been very helpful. I smile. He turns to go. Can you remind me the way out? He waves a hand at one of the doors.
Go down there, second door on the left. You can't miss it.
Then he leaves. The second door on the left opens onto a smooth-floored tunnel, lined in white glazed tiles and illuminated by overhead fluorescent tubes of a kind that are sufficiently familiar that when I reach the end of the tunnel and step through the grey metal door, which locks behind me with a muffled click, I am unsurprised to find myself in a passage between two tube platforms. Half an hour and a change of line later, I swipe my Oyster card and surface, blinking at the afternoon sun. I pat the inside pocket where I secreted the sheaf of papers that Angleton gave me, and then I head back to my office in the new annex, where I very pointedly dial open my secure document safe and install those papers, then lock it and go home, secure in the knowledge of the first half of a job well done. Like I said, fatal accidents never happen because of just one mistake.
This ends Disc 5.